Today is Monday, May 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
A very controversial move. He crossed a police seal or broke a police seal on the building to turn the electricity back on at the weekend. And this has angered government officials, and in particular, the Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrives at the EU headquarters in Brussels. And Saudi Arabia says two of its oil tankers suffered significant damage in a sabotage attack. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has arrived at the EU headquarters in Brussels for the first stop on his European trip. State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortagas said today that Pompeo will meet with European allies in Belgium to discuss recent threatening actions and statements by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Originally, Pompeo had planned to meet today with U.S. diplomats and business leaders in Moscow. There was a change of plans late yesterday instead for the secretary to stop in Belgium first. And for more on the U.S. Secretary of State's trip is VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, who is joining me by phone. Thank you so much, Cindy.
My pleasure.
Well, Cindy, can you tell us what are the expectations from the meeting in Brussels?
Well, as you said, this is all a bit impromptu and last minute. One might say that Secretary Pompeo is crashing a meeting that was already planned in Brussels with the British Foreign Secretary and the French Foreign Minister and the German Foreign Minister and the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Mogherini. And Mogherini, when asked that, when told that Pompeo was on his way, she said, well, we have a full lineup of meetings here, but of course he's always welcome. And we did hear, we are getting word from the State Department that Pompeo is to meet with her, and after he met with the NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg. But we had a rather unusual, bold, stark warning from the British Foreign Secretary Hunt, saying with all this escalation of rhetoric between the U.S. and Iran, there's a real danger of an accidental conflict or war. So it looks like the Europeans are very worried about all these tensions going on.
Sure, that's very interesting. As you said, this seems to be overshadowing his trip. And I know that Secretary of State Pompeo is due to meet in Russia this week as well. So what is the expectation there with all of this tension?
Right. Well, yes, as far as we know, as planned, he's set to meet in Sochi at the Black Sea Resort with Russian President Putin and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov. And the Russians have said that they'll be talking about Iran. They'll be talking about North Korea, Venezuela, of course, the nuclear accord between the U.S. and Russia, and a whole host of issues. And we're seeing some. We don't have any confirmation here from the State Department or from the White House yet, but we're hearing some reports from Russia that there may be a summit announced between President Trump and President Putin. So a lot going on, and but as you well said, these tensions with Iran, and now we have this situation also with the Saudi tanker, is tending to overshadow everything else.
Yes, and also what has been the reaction with the USS Abraham aircraft carrier being there and the B-52 bombers?
Right, and I think that may have been partly what the British Foreign Secretary may have been referring to as far as escalation. I think the Europeans are very concerned, but of course the U.S., for its part, has said that Secretary Pompeo was asked again about it today, and he said that the U.S. Is reacting to very real threats from Iran, and they haven't come out and said it, but it seems like they're referring to potential threats against American military forces, possibly based in Iraq. So the U.S. is boosting its firepower there, and Pompeo and also here from the Pentagon, spokesman saying, we don't want a war, and we're not trying to provoke anything, but if U.S. our Americans are attacked, we want to be in a position to be able to respond to that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That's VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain speaking with me from here in Washington. Well, sabotage attacks on oil tankers in the territorial waters of the United Arab Emirates are stoking fears of a possible conflict with Iran. Some Arab analysts accused Tehran being responsible for the attacks yesterday, while Iran is calling for further investigation into the incidents. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media broadcast amateur video purporting to show a Saudi oil tanker burning heavily in the UAE port of Fujairah Sunday. The UAE indicated four ships were damaged. The UAE Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Anwar Gargash, said deliberate sabotage of the four vessels took place within the UAE's territorial waters. Saudi oil minister Khalid al-Falah indicated two Saudi tankers were heavily damaged in a sabotage attack, but that there was no loss of life and no oil was spilled. He said the attack was meant to undermine the security of oil supplies to consumers all over the world. The Arab League, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Egypt, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Jordan all condemned the attack in Fujairah, expressing support and solidarity with the UAE. A number of Arab analysts accused Iran of the attack. Saudi analyst Isam al-Malikawi told Sky News Arabia he thinks Iran staged the attack in Fujairah to help improve the morale of its people, which are suffering from the economic sanctions imposed by the United States. But he says Iran does not understand that it is playing with fire and could ignite a larger conflict. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Abbas Mousawi called for further investigation, warning the incident may have been part of a plot by parties trying to create havoc in the region. Khatar Abu Diab, a political science professor at the University of Paris, tells VOA he thinks the Gulf region is now in a critical period where things could either escalate or calm down. He says some parties in Iran might be looking to provoke a crisis via proxy.
He
says Iran had a habit during the first Gulf War from around 1984 of taking a provocative stance against certain Gulf countries, mounting operations against international shipping to show their presence and send messages to certain countries, especially those who are trying to replace their oil exports. Abu Diab said it is more likely that Iran would try to launch an attack via one of its proxies in Syria, Lebanon, or Iraq than to attack any Gulf country directly, since that could provoke U.S. retaliation against its own territory. Arab media reported the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Lincoln has now passed the Bab al-Mandeb off the coast of Yemen en route to the Persian Gulf. The U.S. has also sent B-52 bombers to the Udaid Air Base in Qatar. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Among the top stories in the world, the Philippines held its midterm elections today with a vote expected to consolidate President Rodrigo Duterte's power in Congress. Albania's center-right opposition calls for further protests as it continues a months-long effort to bring about the resignation of the left-wing government and force early parliamentary elections. And Sri Lanka blocks access to Facebook and WhatsApp after Christian attacks on mosque and Muslim-owned stores yesterday in reaction to a Facebook post. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Swedish prosecutors are reopening a rape case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Today in Stockholm, Eva Marie Persson, deputy director of public prosecutions, said there is still a probable cause to suspect that Assange committed rape, adding that in her assessment, a new questioning of Assange is required. person said the circumstances now allow for the extradition of Assange from Britain. However, she said it is for Britain to decide whether to extradite him to Sweden or to the U.S., where he is wanted for allegedly hacking into a Pentagon computer. Swedish prosecutors filed preliminary charges against Assange in 2010. The investigation into alleged sexual misconduct was dropped 7 years later after Assange sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and prosecutors said the case could not move forward. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from Spain's University of Barcelona and the French Besançon Astronomical Observatory suggests that the Milky Way galaxy experienced a period of intense star-making about 2 to 3 billion years ago. Writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, the scientists reached their findings by analyzing data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. The researchers say they found that about half of the stars that make up the Milky Way's galactic disk were created during the stellar baby boom. Before the time of this boost in star formation, the scientists suggest that our galaxy was beginning to run low on the gas used to make stars when a satellite galaxy crashed into and merged with the Milky Way. It's thought that the satellite galaxy was rich with this gas, and when it merged with our home galaxy, boosted its star-making capabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Coming up this Sunday, Mother's Day special.
Yeah, mama. Whoa.
55 minutes of your favorite African songs that speak to, for, and about your mamas. Or about you, mamas. Now, one mother and diva of Malian music, Oumou Sangaré, speaks to us from Ouassalon country about her music festival there. And a song of the week features Akodi and her song, Shengerera Mama.
I'm sorry, mama yangu.
So tune in and feel the love. Music Time in Africa, 1505 and 20500 Universal Time.
China said today it would impose tariffs on $60 billion worth of imports from the United States, retaliating after President Donald Trump boosted taxes on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods sent to the U.S. and moved to impose duties on another $300 billion of Chinese exports. The Chinese Finance Ministry said its new 5% to 25% tax would be imposed June 1st and affect 5,140 U.S. products exported to China. Beijing said its response was targeting U.S. unilateralism and trade protectionism. The new Chinese taxes came hours after Trump on Twitter urged China not to strike back, claiming that China has taken so advantage of the U.S. for so many years that they are way ahead, therefore China should not retaliate, will only get worse, says Trump. VOA's Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Philip Levy, a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, on the failed U.S.-China trade talks.
This seems to be a clear negotiating failure on the part of the United States, that if President Trump had wanted to have a breakdown and impose tariffs, he would have been much better off doing that with his original deadline, which was January 1st. Here he signaled weakness and then stuck tariffs on anyways, which I think has left the Chinese fairly confused.
What do you think the Chinese, Mr. Liu, was expecting when he flew here for talks with the U.S. negotiators?
I doubt much of what happened surprised him. I think China did not want to be seen as walking away from the table unilaterally. I think the odds of reaching a successful conclusion plummeted when the president put the tariffs on. The Chinese could not be seen to be giving in the face of threats. So he probably expected to hear the U.S. position, and that's what he got.
How much of this is the saving face part of the Chinese personality?
Oh, it's very important that I don't think that there's politics in China just like in the U.S., even though obviously they're quite different and it's not a democracy, but it still does matter, and it was never going to be viable to have President Trump figuratively speaking, shake a big stick at them and then have them concede that same week.
Where does this leave the whole situation?
I think it leaves the administration in a very difficult position. The president seemed to signal optimism, but it's hard to see how they back away from this. It looks like the next step is for the Chinese to retaliate against the United States.
And what does that entail? Obviously, one would think that they're just going to, you know, double what the United States has done back to the United States, right?
Well, they had tried to match the United States tariff for tariff. Of course, part of the thing with this relationship is an underlying imbalance, such that they cannot stick tariffs on as many imports as the U.S. can. But there are other things they can do to make life uncomfortable for the U.S., and I expect we're going to find out what those are.
Any ideas?
They can make life difficult for U.S. companies operating in China. They can make investment difficult. They can oppose us at various international forums if they choose to.
What does this do to the American consumer?
It doesn't do anything good for the American consumer. It, you know, frequently the Chinese were importing things which U.S. consumers didn't use that much of, like sorghum, for example, which was good for American farmers, that there were pork products that were parts of a chicken the U.S. didn't tend to consume. So those things don't have good alternative markets. It's not that the consumers are going to be thrilled with that. Consumers are going to face higher costs when they're buying goods that either were directly made in China or that used parts made in China.
That was Philip Levy, a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Well, U.S. stock market indexes fell more than 2% today after China imposed tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. imports. China's move follows President Donald Trump's decision last week to impose new 25% tariffs on Chinese goods. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down more than 600 points after a few hours of trading today. Stock markets in Tokyo, London, and Shanghai all fell earlier in the day. Gold prices, however, rose about 1% as investors look for safe places to put their money. Oil prices also were up modestly. A Roman Catholic cardinal backed by Pope Francis has created a political firestorm and divided Italy's government by breaking a police seal and restoring electricity to a building occupied by some 450 migrants in Rome. Cardinal Konrad Krajewski said he was fully aware of the possible legal consequences, but acted in the conviction that it was done for the good of the families. I spoke with Josephine McKenna about the incident and the political fallout, as well as Italy's move to return migrants to Libya.
Well, this is a very interesting move from the Vatican. Cardinal Konrad Krajewski, a Polish cardinal who acts as the man who carries out acts of charity in the Pope's name here in Rome, has gone to a building to restore electricity. This is a building occupied by 150 homeless families and migrants. A very controversial move. He crossed a police seal or broke a police seal on the building to turn the electricity back on at the weekend. And this has angered government officials, and in particular the Interior Minister Matteo Salvini, who says that this is inappropriate and the Vatican should not be taking this kind of action.
What is the Vatican going to do, and are they going to pay for the electricity?
The minister not only attacked the cardinal for supporting what he called illegal conduct, he said, if the Vatican wants to pay the bills of all Italians facing hardship, we will give them an account to do that. Now, the cardinal has said that he is happy to pay the bill, but there are unpaid electricity bills going back to the beginning of May when the electricity was cut off, unpaid bills totaling around 300,000 euros. So that's a huge bill. I'm not sure if the Vatican can pay all of that. But it's certainly a very strong political move here by someone who's very close to the Pope and no doubt carrying out his wishes, trying to take care of the poor, trying to respond to the needs of migrants and ensure that people are taken care of.
Will there be any charges filed against the cardinal?
It's not clear at this point whether the government will take action. I think that would be a very controversial move. But there's no doubt that this is about the Pope seizing the political agenda and trying to send a message to his political enemies within the Vatican and outside the Vatican that he wants to represent those in the community who have no voice. That has already put him in conflict with Matteo Salvini, this hardline interior minister who's anti-immigrant. So they've clashed in the past, and Now it looks like they're once again divided over this issue about whether to take care of the poor and whether to take care of migrants.
And looking at another situation involving migrants, the migrants now being sent back to Libya.
That's a huge issue. As we know, this current Italian government that's been in place for a year now is very hard line, has essentially closed the ports to migrants crossing the Mediterranean. That's become even more of an issue now with the conflict we're seeing in Libya. And in the last few days, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, estimate that over 600 refugees and migrants have attempted to flee Libya. The majority have been forcibly returned and placed in detention centres, including, they say, in Tripoli, where there's active conflict. So a great deal of concern, and we're also seeing Sea-Watch returning to the Mediterranean, heading towards Libya to try and rescue migrants. And already Matteo Salvini, the Italian Interior Minister, is warning that vessel not to bring anyone near the coast of Italy because those migrants will not be allowed to enter Italy. So a very hard line from Italy and no sign of any changes in the near future.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. Well, the United Nations said yesterday that the redeployment of Houthi forces from key ports in Yemen went in accordance with established plans. The redeployment efforts began Saturday in accordance with an agreement in December reached in Sweden between Yemen's government and the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels. Tomorrow, the UN is to verify the first phase of Houthi troop withdrawal, seen as a key step to ending the four-year war in Yemen. Well, Yemen's 4 years of civil war have taken the hardest toll on women and girls. In one remote desert village, the U.S. aid group International Rescue Committee has established a center for teaching skills and empowerment to vulnerable women and girls. Reporter Neha Wadakar has more.
Entikab Ali Abdulawasi, a mother of five girls, fled fighting in her home in Taiz to the remote village of Ras Amran. And as many Yemeni men have lost livelihoods, for some, even their lives, women and girls are finding themselves in unfamiliar territory as the new breadwinners of the family. Abdulawasi's husband is safe, but has been too sick to work. She says she and her daughters are learning new skills so they can get out of poverty and help their family. With her husband sick, Abdulawasi says it is important for women and girls to learn skills to be able to survive and provide for the house. Abdulawasi and her daughters attend classes in the Al Bareka Center, founded by the New York-based International Rescue Committee, to empower Yemen's women. Fairuz Yassin, a caseworker at the center, says about 50 women and girls are trained daily or simply spend time there, a safe space close to home. She says in this area of Ras Amran, the people are very traditional. Women often do not leave their homes because they do not want to mix with the men. If they go to other places to learn, they must ride on public transportation. But many of their husbands at home forbid them from doing so and from leaving the area. For women like Abdulawasi, this is also a chance to break free from Yemen's conservative cultural norms and enter the workplace for the first time. She says that before the war, women in Yemen had been forgotten. But when the organizations came to remote areas in Yemen because of the war, the women and girls were able to advance themselves and their skills. According to Fairuz Yassin, the center also provides counseling for gender-based issues and abuse that caseworkers say has shown a marked increase with the fighting in Yemen. She says the caseworkers are seeing higher levels of domestic violence due to the pressures men are facing because of the war. Men are taking all their anger out on their wives. For the men that leave home for long periods of time, the women then had to become everything. Then she would be struggling with mental illness and trauma because of the war, and she would reach a point where she cannot handle it anymore, and this would bring the woman to the center. The center is already shifting gender dynamics in the community. Abdulawasi says her husband supports her plan to one day open her own tailoring shop and to run it with her daughters. Neha Wadakar, VOA News, Ras Amran, Yemen.
That wraps up International Edition. Thanks for joining us.